Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm just a caveman.
Due to habeas corpus, you and Miss Bonifante had a common law marriage.
So you don't work on a contingency basis?
No, money down. Oops, shouldn't have this bar association logo here either.
Would you please point at that robot over there? No further questions.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode number 74, coming at you nice and live and fast with that same day record. I'm super excited about that. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am great. I love our new, more responsive schedule. And that is really thanks to, so like I said, I keep saying this, it's a little bit more work for me and it is a lot more work for you. And we've gotten you some help. So
yeah, it's looking good. We're testing out having someone edit. And I'm excited because, you know, I've got a baby on the way and a wrist injury that will not go away. No jokes. That's from editing. I don't want to hear it. That's going to be pretty cool.
But that's a real, you know, one of the things we talk about with Patreon is, you know, the ability for us to hire an editor. Do we want to give him a shout out?
Yeah. Special shout out to Brian. He's going to edit this episode and the next episode. And I think it's going to work out. He seems really awesome. So excited. Yeah. I put out a call for help and a lot of people answered. By the way, any of my friends listening on Facebook who answered that call for help, thank you. It was overwhelming. I had to kind of go first come, first serve, and we're going to try it out.
Yeah, and Alicia has been helping us out in the production role. And
yeah, good point. Let's call out our awesome helpers because really, yeah, Alicia's doing a great job too.
Yep. So thank you. And again, thanks to our patrons. That makes it possible for us to do that, which in turn we think brings you a better show. So
yeah, and it makes it possible for us to talk about Covfef before, like right as everyone's tired of it, like just maybe like a few hours late. Because before we would have talked about it, what, 5-6 days later. Now it's just when you're all tired of it.
Yeah, no, it is.
We're going to talk about a legal angle to Covfef. Don't worry, we're not just making the same meme jokes everyone is making.
Yeah, let's do that. Angle to Covfef.
And first, we've got to talk about the fact that, yeah, there's kind of an elephant in the room of the last episode, which I just want to say got a lot of great feedback and also a lot of, wasn't sure I liked that feedback. We heard you. We respect your feedback. Thanks so much for everybody who commenting either way. But we're going to talk more about that on Tuesday because Andrew has a lot to talk about today. Current events and stuff that we really want to get to. So we're gonna save that for Tuesday, but we're going to dive a little more into not just talking more about that debate, because I don't think that would be that interesting, but Andrew has some good lessons for how to research the law if you're a layperson. I think that'll be a good segment regardless of the past episode.
Yeah. And we are also going to talk about my favorite piece of breaking news, which is Mr. Met flipping off the fans in Milwaukee. That's going to be great. And we're going to talk about that on our usual, just as this is off of everyone's radar.
Yeah. Well, I love that we have so much breaking news to get into that we had. It's like some of it, Mr. Met, unfortunately, we had to tell Mr. Met, like, sorry, man, you didn't make the cut here. We're having to move you to Tuesday.
Yep.
All right. Well, with all that said, let's get to our first segment of the day.
I'm asking you if you know the difference between right and wrong.
I discovered at a very early age that if I talk long enough, I could make anything right or wrong. So either I'm God or truth is relative. And in either case, booyah.
Oh, interesting. It's just the average person has a much harder time saying booyah to moral relativism.
Ooh, my favorite kind of segment. I don't know if we made a new intro for this. Andrew is wrong. What's the segment intro for Andrew having to do a correction? Because it'll never happen. It'll happen like twice a year. But, you know, it'll be worthwhile.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know, maybe we can get like Yakety Sax or, you know. I don't want to give you and Brian any ideas, but. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, I someone pointed this out to me too, and I looked it up because I didn't believe it, and then I looked it up. So I'm curious to hear Andrew apologize profusely for getting something wrong. Ready to go.
Yeah, no, I will apologize for getting the factual piece of data wrong, and I want to explain kind of the nuance behind the point that I still stand behind. Mm-hmm. So Sean Keehan wrote and said that in our episode on gerrymandering, it was not the first time that I claimed that the Democrats won more total votes in the U.S. House of Representatives over the past three election cycles. That is not true. I'm wrong on the numbers. It is true in 2012. So I want to go through very, very quickly what each of the numbers are and how it was reflected in the actual Congress, because I think my point still stands that gerrymandering is overrepresenting Republicans in the House of Representatives. But it's not true to say Democrats won more votes than Republicans. So what are the numbers? In 2012, which is the trend that I thought continued forward but didn't, Democrats won 1.5 million more votes, about a little over 1%, 49% to 47.5%. And yet they finished with 33 fewer seats in the House of Representatives, 234 Republican, 201 Democratic, even though Democrats won more votes. That's the baseline argument on gerrymandering. That's the clearest. In 2014, the Republicans won 5.5% more votes. So 40 million congressional votes. This was an off year, so the total votes were much lower. In 2012, it was about 60 million votes to about 58 million votes. In 2014, it was 40 million votes to 35.5 million votes, which helps illustrate the point you and I have continually made, Thomas, which is Democrats need to suck less in gubernatorial, non-presidential election years.
2018, we're coming for you. We're coming for you, Republicans.
So that is a 5.5-point shift, 51.2% to 45.5% for the Democrats. Other parties make up the remaining couple of percent there. But the effect of that was the already strong Republican majority gained 13 more seats. So they held a 247 to 188 seat majority. That is 59, net 59 seats. That is plus 13.5% in terms of the percentage of the House. So again, Republicans won. They won by 5.5%, but it translated into a 13.5% gain in the actual House itself. And then in 2016, Republicans very narrowly, 63 million to 61.7 million. So 1%, 49% to 48% won the majority in Congress. But of that incredibly slim majority, right, 49 to 48, is nevertheless a 241 to 194 majority in Congress. So you see a baseline, right? In other words, you would expect 50-50 to be 218 to 217, and it's not. 50-50 is approximately 230 to 205 Republican advantage. So the gerrymandering is, number one, it's giving Republicans a 25-seat advantage in the House of Representatives as a baseline. And number two, and I think this is sort of even the larger problem, is it creates the situation where the biggest risk in these elections is losing the primary rather than losing the general election. And that's why, even though Trump is at 35% in the polls, right? Like, but he's in the 80s with Republicans.
Hey, some polls have him as much as like 38, okay?
Yeah.
Andrew, to be fair.
When a president is historically, when a president is below 40% in the polls, you see revolt in the ranks.
Yeah.
And the fact that you don't see revolt in the ranks is an indication that members of Congress,
they're not worried about that part of it.
They're worried about a different thing.
Yeah.
They're worried about losing in the primary, because if you come out and you criticize Trump, then, you know, some individual is going to run against you in the primary, you know, from a pro-Trump right, and has a better chance of beating you when the activists are really, really high than you do of losing in the general election in these super safe districts. So, you know, I stand by the general point, but I truly do, and this is the spirit of our engagement with Travis on Tuesday. I really, really appreciate Sean. We do our best to get things right around here. We do a lot of research for the show, but continue to fact check us. Don't believe it just because I've said it or Thomas has said it. Particularly if you can find something Thomas has said that's wrong like that. I would love.
Hey, Andrew doesn't get to see the mail I get over on my other show. Yeah, no. I totally echo that. Yeah. I want us to be accurate. I'm happy to be held to a very high standard.
Love it.
And it takes a little getting used to. You know, it sucks to have a bunch of people, you know, when you say something wrong, you get a billion emails of a bunch of people saying, "Hey, idiot, you said this wrong." But, you know, I'm getting used to it. It's good. It's a healthy thing. I think it makes it just that much more. I think it makes our show that much more valuable, because, you know, we will absolutely correct something if we get something wrong. So in general, you can feel confident that we are searching for the truth. We're not trying to just get away with lying to you about anything.
Yep.
So one thing this is just a quick thing. I don't know if you'll have any sort of answer for this, and maybe the stupidest question of all time. I don't really understand how in 2016 Democrats won the popular vote by 3 million ish and lost the congressional vote by 1.3 million. Does that mean people split their ticket? Does that mean when they looked at the representatives they could vote for, they just were like, "Nah, I'm not going to vote on that"? How does that even work? I don't really get it.
Yeah, it's both of those, but it means that there are a significant number of ticket splitters. I will tell you, historically, those numbers used to be much, much higher, right? Mm. That people would go out and vote for Hillary Clinton for president, and then vote for Republican candidates for Senate or Congress.
I don't mean to say that's necessarily a bad thing. I just was confused. Like, I didn't get why. Like, you would think that if Democrats got a higher popular turnout, you would think, wow, you would think they would have won the congressional vote. But apparently I was wrong about that. So
it helps kind of come square against the narrative that, you know, Hillary Clinton was hated or uniquely terrible as a candidate, which, again, you know, you and I don't subscribe to that theory. The fact that she outperformed on average Democratic congressional candidates across the country, I think, helps support that. I think that the clear harm, we've said this multiple times, but where you want to point the blame in the 2016 election are disaffected liberals and my old buddy Nate Silver at 538.com that he deserves to be called out, that like there was so little polling, and Wisconsin and Michigan were sort of dark blue on the 538 maps this is safe. And there was just no enthusiasm among liberals in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. You can't say there was an engagement in Pennsylvania, because there was, obviously. The campaign spent a lot of time there. But the Clinton campaign didn't spend any time in Michigan or Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. They took that for granted. That's a lesson that goes all the way back to opening arguments number one. If you'd never listened to our four-part series on Bush v. Gore, it turned out to be a bit more prophetic than I was hoping at the time.
Yeah.
I said it word for word at the end of OA4, you know, you don't know you're in a swing state until the state goes the other way.
Right. We should go dig that up and just play it, and then we can cry and huddle and together for a little bit. But yeah, you're right. And I made this point too, and I think I'm sorry, I'm just for 2 seconds, I want to make it again. For everybody, to echo what you said, if you're a liberal voter who didn't vote and puts the blame on Hillary, I don't accept that, because if you really believe that Hillary was the problem and you just couldn't vote for her and she's the same as Trump, fine. I disagree forever on that, but fine. What you should have done was gone to the polls, voted for your Democratic representatives on the ticket, and then just left President blank or something. And then we would have seen, like you said, we would have seen the opposite of what we saw. We would have seen Hillary get like no votes and the House Democrats get a bunch of votes, you know? So I don't accept that. It's a lot of people trying to shift blame. And I don't think they're taking responsibility for their actions. So that's sorry. That's a little bit of moralizing there, but it's frustrating because it really, the evidence doesn't bear out that that's what was really even going on. So, all right.
But I now totally agree. I endorse this message.
Thanks. I'm Andrew Torres and I endorse this message.
There you go.
Now we've got to get to a little bit of a nice cup of hot coffee here. And so this happened, and everybody knows about it. So I'm going to take 3.2 seconds to explain. Trump is an idiot, and he tweeted, like an autocorrect looking kind of typo. And then just left it there. And the tweet was just, despite the negative press covfief. And it just sat there for hours and everybody bewildered. The whole country just looked at each other and was like, what is our country right now? And, all the jokes have been made and, of course, made to death. And there's no more joking to be had. But I was curious, Andrew. Listener Thomas S., I don't know that we ever answered the question, and if we did, I forget, so you can answer it again. did we ever answer the question where people were talking about President Trump is not allowed to delete his tweets, like because of the Presidential Records Act? And yeah. I want to know if that's true, if that's something that he's in violation of, or if that's a reason that the tweet would get left out. But it eventually did get deleted, so maybe not. What's going on there?
Okay, so here's the answer, which is it depends on how you read 44 U.S.C. 2201 etsec. And etsec, for those who may or may not remember, means "and the stuff that comes after it." Okay, I think that's what the Latin means, right? And the stuff that comes after it. So the Presidential Records Act was amended in 2014 to include electronic records. Seems to me very clearly covers Twitter. You have a duty as the president to preserve presidential records. I'm not going to read the definition of presidential records because it is defined expansively. What I am going to say is presidential records are defined as excluding personal records. Mm. And subsection 3 of, so this is 44 U.S.C. 2201 subsection 3 says, the term personal records means all documentary materials or any reasonably segregable portion thereof of a purely private or non-public character which do not relate to or have an effect upon the carrying out of the constitutional, statutory, or other official or ceremonial duties of the president. Okay. Such term includes diaries, journals, or other personal notes serving as the functional equivalent of a diary or journal, which are not prepared or utilized for, circulated, or communicated in the course of transacting government business, materials relating to private political associations and having no relation to or direct effect upon the carrying out of constitutional, statutory, or other official or ceremonial duties of the president, and materials relating exclusively to the president's own election to the office of the presidency, and materials directly relating to the election of a particular individual or individuals to federal, state, or local office, which have no relation to or direct effect upon the carrying out of the constitutional, statutory, or other official or ceremonial duties of the president. So the only argument for Trump's Twitter account, as far as I can tell, is that it's a personal record. I read the exception. The exception is very, very clear that it may not have a relation to or an effect upon the constitutional, statutory, official, or ceremonial duties of the president. And the fact that the president conducts official business over his Twitter account, I don't think we even need to document that.
Yeah.
In my view, takes the Twitter out of the context of presidential records. Now, again, there are cases about, not about the president, but there are cases about, official record keeping. You see the exception. I mean, I think this exception is pretty clearly intended to protect you know, private journal, right? And one of the things presidents do, you know, when they get out of office is they write, you know, their memoirs. And so, you know, the way in which you write your memoirs is you keep an ongoing journal.
He needs the exclusive scoop on that. It wouldn't really be, it wouldn't really be able to sell it for $20 million if we all, it's public record that we all can see.
So, so that's the Presidential Records Act. It is yet another thing that, as far as I can tell, Trump is in violation of. I also want to read.
But can I, what is your interpretation on, because there's a couple things. I could see an argument for like, well, despite the negative press cuffief, isn't there's it's not very substantive of a tweet, so maybe that doesn't matter. Or is it just once Twitter itself is classified as a presidential record, then anything he does needs to be preserved? Is that more how it would work?
Right. So here's the answer to that question. Thank you for asking. Otherwise, I would have passed over it. Section 2203C governs how the president may dispose of presidential records of such president that, quote, no longer have administrative, historical, informational, or evidentiary value. Okay, so right, the president can certainly destroy stuff that fits into that category.
Yeah, like if he's writing something down in a memo and he typos it, like pretend it's not Twitter, I'm sure he can throw that away and just say, we don't need record that I typoed something when I was making a memo. Okay.
And here's the here's how that plays out. The president can only destroy those records if, this is C1 and C2, the president obtains the views in writing of the Archivist of the United States concerning the proposed disposal of such presidential records. And number two, the archivist states that the archivist does not intend to take any action under subsection E of this section. And then subsection E is the ways that the archivist can preserve presidential records to be disposed of, whether they are of special interest to the Congress or with consultation with the Congress regarding the disposal of these particular records is in the public interest. And you can understand.
There's some guy that needs to make the call on that. Sounds like
there's an umpire. Archivist of the United States.
So actually, he should be receiving a letter or an email about Cuffeef, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And look, the way in which you do this in the memo context is you put all the memos that have weird typos in it or all the scratch paper into a box. Right. And then every month or so you send the archivist and you're like, okay, sending you a box. This contains all of our typoed information and we're going to destroy it. It seems a little weird and bureaucratic, but
it seems very important, though.
Well, for a lot of reasons, right? Yeah. Like, so, you know, as a lawyer, one of the things you immediately do is you look to the potential worst case scenario. Well, suppose we had a president at which, boy, this doesn't require a lot of hypotheticals. Like, let's start off with Richard Nixon, right? Suppose we had a president who wanted to destroy information that was incriminating about him personally, right? You want to first make sure that you cover that as a crime. And if the president had a catch-all ability with no other review to just destroy, oh, I made a typo, then he could use that provision to destroy materials that were personally
incriminating. Yeah, when I admitted wrongdoing, I accidentally made a typo there. It was I before E and stuff.
Right. So, and this is of no historical value. That's why you have the archivist. That's why you have the provision that says, the archivist can look at it and say, even if this doesn't have any present value, that this may have this may be of interest to the Congress or may be of interest to the public.
You know, I have another question. I'm sorry. This is really fascinating, actually. I didn't realize there'd be so much behind this. But how would it work legally when let's say this is a crime and somehow Donald Trump is being held to account. Would he be able to say, look, on Twitter, it's all saved instantly. Like everybody saves this immediately. Like there's probably a website like Web Archive or something. I don't know. There's some website that I think saves all the tweets anyway. Like, so it doesn't matter. Would that be a defense or would that not matter?
Well, you could make that argument, but subsection A of 2203 says through the implementation of records management controls and other necessary actions, the president shall take all such
so
steps.
So he still has the duty to do it.
As may be necessary to assure that, that records are, quote, adequately documented and that such records are preserved and maintained as presidential records pursuant to the requirements of this section and other provisions of law. So
you know what
the
this fact is, that, Andrew? Yeah. You know what this is? Clear
it's
as
Yodel
Kushner.
Mountain.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good one too. It's both Yodel Mountain and Clear as Kushner, I think.
Yep. I agree. And I want to bring your attention to a particular provision, section 2209, that was added in 2014. And let me tell you, and let me ask if maybe you can think about why this particular section was added in 2014. What might have been going through the Republican, the strongly Republican Congress's mind in 2014?
My official answer is either Benghazi or the emails or both.
Right. Yeah. So this is not a Benghazi section in the public records. This says, in general, the president, vice president, or covered employee may not create or send a presidential or vice presidential record using a non-official electronic message account unless the president, vice president, or covered employee copies an official electronic messaging account in the original creation or transmission of the presidential record or forwards a complete copy of the presidential or vice presidential record to an official electronic messaging account not later than 20 days after the original creation or transmission of a presidential or vice presidential record. The intentional violation of subsection A shall be basis for a disciplinary action in accordance with subchapter 1, 2, or 5 of chapter 75 of Title V, as the case may be. So this very clearly, I mean, again, thinking about the context in which it was created, Donald Trump is using not only his unsecured personal phone, but his non-official real Donald Trump Twitter account. And it seems to me to be a pretty clear statutory violation of this section 2209. Now, if I were the reason that I'm not sure this counts for Yodel Mountain is I think it is not difficult to make an argument that there is a distinction between the term disciplinary action and high crimes and misdemeanors. So, you know, you could argue that they wouldn't have used that language in the statute if they meant that it was an impeachable offense. On the other hand, right, the counter argument would be, well, because the president is immune from prosecution while in office, the only possible disciplinary action you can take against him is impeachment.
Good point. So, what else is he going to make him write his name on the board a bunch of times or whatever? Yeah, like,
we're very disappointed in you, President Trump. So
I think it definitely is clear as Kushner, though. It's clear as Kushner, but maybe not Yodel Mountain is what I'm saying.
Right. That's exactly like, right.
Arguably Yodel Mountain.
That's only for 2209. Right. The destruction, the deletion of the Kafifi tweet is a clear violation of 2203. I don't see the argument to the contrary because you have to go through the process. And I get it that like all of us, I mean, I've deleted stupid tweets I've made.
Yeah, but we're not the friggin' president.
I'm not the president. That's exactly right. And history, if you think about it, you know, so much in history helps us tell the story 100 years later, 200 years later, when we're looking at personal correspondence and we're looking at, you know, accidental, there weren't accidental tweets and emails 200 years ago, but mistakes people made, right?
People tweeted more carefully back then. There were no accidental tweets.
Yeah, it's. I can tell you back then when I was tweeting.
Everyone dotted their I's and But this is really interesting. I'm so glad that we tackled this. That's interesting. So that's one of those things. If you see shared on, I suppose, Occupy Democrats or something, maybe it's not a liberal conspiracy theory. Sounds like All right, well, let's get to our main topic of the day. All right, Andrew, so we'll see if this is Yodel Mountain or Clear as Kushner or maybe none of the above or both of the above. We'll see. But there seems to be a a virus going around of people not wanting to cooperate with congressional inquiries. And we've talked a little bit about that, what you can and can't do, you know, pleading the fifth.
Yeah, the virus seems to be that people are allergic to complying with an ongoing congressional investigation. This is being led out of the Senate Intelligence Committee by Republican Richard Burr of North Carolina and Democrat Mark Warner of Virginia. And the first step in any congressional investigation is a voluntary request. And so a voluntary request is exactly what it sounds like. You can decline to cooperate with a voluntary request. When you do that, Congress, if the specific committee has been delegated the authority, can go back and issue subpoenas. Subpoenas have the force of law. They require you to appear and or to produce documents. We've talked about that distinction. That is called a subpoena.
Oh, deuces take them.
Deuces take them. There you go.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Your vocabulary. We need to do a revised Thomas vocabulary.
Yeah, but just ask all the ones I know. Okay, guys.
Right. I can do that.
We'll do a revised. It'll be another set of things I've never heard of, and I kind of fail miserably again.
No, that was a lot of fun. We need to do that again.
Yeah, it was actually.
And that you cannot decline to answer a subpoena. What you can do is, in answering the subpoena, you can make objections. And when you make objections, it is then up to the, in a civil lawsuit, it's either up to the parties to resolve amongst themselves amicably, or ultimately it is up to the judge, or if there's a special magistrate that's been appointed, the magistrate, to resolve the issues for refusal to comply with a subpoena. So what are some of the reasons you might refuse to comply with some or all of a subpoena?
We've gone over some of them, right? There's some amount of Fifth Amendment, right?
Right.
Let's take them
individually, right? Okay. The Fifth Amendment is your right not to incriminate yourself for potential criminal liability. And so you may assert that with respect to any piece of evidence that may tend to make the establishment of a fact more likely that could lead to you having criminal liability. But that would still exclude, there are sort of two limitations to taking the Fifth, right? Number one is there may be huge categories of documents that don't relate to that specific charge, right? That mm-hmm. may not incriminate you. And the second thing that we talked about is a prosecutor can always get around an assertion of Fifth Amendment privilege by immunizing the witness. And you can give transactional immunity, which is to say, we'll state in writing that the government may not use the documents that you have produced in any criminal proceeding against you. And that's different than blanket immunity. We've talked about that distinction before. Blanket immunity says we will not pursue criminal charges against you. Transactional immunity says we're not going to use these particular documents against you, but they could still, you know, present charges against you. They would just have to gather other evidence. So That's taking the Fifth. That's one basis not to comply with the subpoena. What others are there?
Well, there's now I'm thinking more in the corporate realm. Now mm-hmm. that I think about it, those are the ones I remember, and I don't think that's going to apply here. So do we want to go over those?
I think they should, because remember, one of the things that was used about Michael Flynn you've taken five. Now what we're going to do is subpoena your corporate records. So absolutely.
So yeah, if it's an undue burden, right? If they say, and actually I think this is, we could have covered this. I think this is something Google did recently when mm-hmm. when asked to provide records of how much their female employees make relative to their male employees. They said, this is too hard. It's going to cost X number of dollars in man hours, so we can't do it. So right, that's one of them, right?
Yep, absolutely. Undue burden. And related to undue burden are claims of lack of relevance, right? Like you can see if something is very, very tangential and would be very, very expensive in civil litigation, you know, for example, if, you know, suppose I sued you, Thomas, for breach of contract, and then I sent a subpoena to Google and said, you know, I want the record of, you know, every activity Thomas has taken on Google since breaching this contract in 2016. Google,
you can't
like,
do that, right? We definitely can't. That's definitely got to be illegal, right?
They've also they have records of your incognito browsing too. I hate to break that to you, but
why are you telling me that? I don't.
No one has anything to hide.
Are you targeting me with this?
No, and Google would say, look, like this is a tremendous burden. We're not a party to this lawsuit. And the information that you're likely to get is incredibly tangential in any event.
Yeah.
So we're just not going to do it. And, you know, again, the way in which a court evaluates that assertion is by balancing out the relevance to the litigation against the costs.
Right.
And again, you can effectively immunize a corporation on that claim by, if it's a small business. I've had this happen in cases. You know, I had a Lloyd's of London case that was, there was over $1 billion in potential liability at stake. And we served a third party request on a tiny startup, and the startup refused to comply. They filed their objections and they said, look, this would require going through the emails and we only have 3 employees and it would take us, you know, months and we wouldn't be able to do our business in the time. And I went into court and said, we're willing to pay an outside contractor to go in and search through those emails. And
so you can hire someone to do it.
Yeah. And then the judge looked and said, does that, you know, solve your client's objection? Yeah, it does. So, you know, and again,
I was going to ask about that. Yeah, that's interesting that you could hire someone to do that. I guess it makes sense. And then there was also another objection, which is like privileged kind of corporate information, right? They don't have to be required to give up their secrets for stuff,
yep,
right?
Yep. So 2 parts of that. First, what constitutes attorney-client privilege? This is narrower than a lot of people think. One of the very first things that I had to do that most graduating law students will do if you go into big firm work, which I don't
go through
recommend.
A bunch of boring papers and
you do
code them or something.
You go through document review and you are required to make privilege calls in, you know, large scale litigation, and you will get a little training session from your firm on what constitutes privilege. So let me tell you what most people think constitutes privilege, which is person A sends a note to person B and copies person C, who happens to be P. Andrew Torres Esquire. Not necessarily privilege. P. Andrew Torres Esquire sends a memo to Thomas Smith on legal stationery that says privileged and confidential at the top. Not necessarily privilege. The privilege attaches in one of 2 ways. It attaches when you seek or receive legal advice, or when the attorney prepares work product on your behalf, legal work product on your behalf. So
it's not just any conversation between you and I because I've paid you for legal services. It's not quite as broad as people think. Is
correct. And if you, one of the things that happens, look, one of the things that happens often, I've litigated this issue, is in many cases, attorneys are part of corporate deal teams. Right? Because look, like I spend my days negotiating deals. It makes sense that if you have a business deal, you might want somebody who has some experience with that, you know, on your team, acting in a business capacity. I also, with many of my clients, the advice I give a lot of legal advice of, hey, this is how you want to structure your business. This is how you want this contract to look. This is some potential liability. But I also give business advice, right? Here's where, you know, this document is being used to target these kinds of customers. Have you thought about like where your customer base is? You know, have you thought about how you're, you know, for some of the podcasting clients I have, I thought about how you're growing your audience, that sort of thing. If you ask me for business advice and I give it to you, that's not privileged. If you ask me to negotiate a business deal on your behalf and it doesn't involve any legal component to it, that's not privileged. If I opine to you about something and you haven't asked me about it, that's not privileged. So the category of what constitutes attorney work product or attorney client communications is narrower than a lot of people think. And just sticking a lawyer on the document is kind of the equivalent, you know, I would say it's kind of the equivalent to, you know, using the statement, well, this is only my opinion, but to try and immunize yourself from libel, right? Like,
yeah.
you cannot say demonstrably false things about somebody and put, you know, in my opinion, Hillary Clinton, you know, murders and chops up babies and sells them in a pizza. Like, that's still libel. That's still defamation, I should say. Yeah, like sticking a lawyer on it does not necessarily render a document privileged. The other component of that is the protection from the disclosure of proprietary, confidential, sensitive business information. Right. That's what Google asserted in that lawsuit. And there's an easy solution to that that is likely to be disappointing to people who want to get their hands on Google's data, which is to say,
it wasn't just, okay, we'll do this in a closed room somewhere where only the... Yeah,
you enter a protective order, and it then, because trials are by default, they are open to the public, and records thereof are public records. So you don't. I got a question. I think I answered it on Twitter or Facebook, but I'll answer it again here about the Google lawsuit and whether when they produce those records, if they'll be subject to FOIA requests. And the answer was, number one, if they produce the records in a public hearing, you won't need to make a FOIA request. They will be part of the public record, and you can go to the courthouse or go online and through Pacer and download the documents, which lots and lots of people are waiting to do in the Google case. But the second half of that, which is if Google refuses, ultimately the solution that will be worked out in that case is they will be produced subject to a protective order. The plaintiffs will say, look, we will receive the documents. We will agree not to disclose them to anybody who's not a party to the litigation and agree to destroy them or return them to Google at the conclusion of the litigation. And courts routinely will say, yeah, well, that satisfies our competitive requirements. You might ask, what happens if it's a direct competitor to Google that sues Google? And they're going to, you know, so I start...
Yeah, I don't think we've tackled that one.
Yeah, I start Andrew's Tasty Fried Chicken, and I subpoena... I sue Kentucky Fried Chicken, and I subpoena them to produce their, you know, original recipe of 11 herbs and spices that they keep under lock and key, and they decline under this provision that it is confidential, proprietary, sensitive business information. And I say, yeah, no, we'll enter into a protective order, and then I still get to get my hands on the secret recipe.
Yeah.
And the answer is that courts can enter an order restricting the material to lawyers only. They can say your client cannot see these documents. And typically in those kinds of cases, what you do is, you know, because presumably I'm asking to see the documents for a pretextual reason, that then the court would say, okay, we're going to let the lawyer see the documents. We're going to resolve this threshold issue. If the recipe for the 11 herbs and spices contains, you know, whatever my allegation is, then, you know, then we'll admit it. But if not, you know, then they're going to have to turn that document back over. So a protective order can be very, very, very narrow to resolve sort of all of those issues. So ultimately, you know, that's not going to relieve you of your burden of production, but it may relieve you of the potential misuse of that document by a competitor.
All right. But what's going on with Kushner's lawyer? Because to go back to what you said at the outset of this, I didn't know. So the first request is kind of like a polite request. It sounds like it's like, hey, come help us out. And it sounds like it's not illegal to just say, nah. But then once they start subpoenaing, then it's where you start having to use all these defenses if you're trying to get out of it.
Right. And Kushner's lawyer has said if a subpoena is issued, he will comply with the subpoena. And the reason he said that is because Congress has the inherent power to conduct investigations. And it is not authorized by statute. It is considered an inherent power of the Congress, you know, dating back to Article 1 of the Constitution. And the case that allows them to do that is this is really an example of how, you know, different events in our history, you know, may shape history going forward. Is a case called Wilkinson versus United States, 365 U.S. 399. 1961 case. And that case involved a target of the House Committee on Un-American Activities.
Oh.
And that he refused to participate in the process. And the Supreme Court said the Committee on Un-American Activities is a standing committee of the House of Representatives elected at the commencement of each Congress. And it is authorized to investigate the extent, character, and objects of un-American propaganda activities in the United States, the diffusion within the United States of subversive and un-American propaganda that is instigated from foreign countries or of a domestic origin and attacks the principle form of government guaranteed by our Constitution, and three, all other legal questions in relation thereto that would aid Congress in any necessary remedial legislation, and therefore you could be held in criminal contempt of Congress for refusing to comply with the House Un-American Activities Committee. And historically, I mean, I think we know. I mean, that was
yeah. Well, wait, sorry. Maybe I'm a little confused now. So that's saying you have to comply, but. But so what's the difference between complying and like a subpoena? Because I thought it was cool to say
it means that they can issue. So the key part, the reason I read that is because it's that third aspect of the organization of the committee that says they are out to investigate X and Y and Z and are authorized then to gather information that is in furtherance of those goals. And that gathering information includes the subpoena power.
I guess I mistook that to say it sounded more broad, like you just have to cooperate no matter what, which sounded different from what you said initially. Yeah. So that's just what gives them the Supreme Court ruling that for sure establishes the fact that they can subpoena people.
Yeah. And okay. And in this case, the defendant was asked to produce evidence relating to communist colonization and infiltration in the textile and other basic industries located in the South and Communist Party propaganda activities, and was held in contempt of Congress, which is a criminal offense. You can be thrown in jail for that, for refusal to comply. So, you know, terrible moment in our nation's history, as you know, as we all know, but gave rise to the notion that the Congress does have this inherent power to conduct investigatory activities and to use the force of law and the ability to issue subpoena powers to back up those investigations. Because just saying Congress can investigate, but if you don't comply with the investigation, nothing will happen to you, you know, is right. You might as well not give them the power to investigate. Right. Okay. So there you go. I thought it was interesting that, you know, kind of as a historical quirk, the McCarthy era witch hunts have led to, you know, hopefully something that can be used in demonstrating
in a
the
real
potential
witch hunt,
collusion.
A good witch hunt. Right. Yeah. Right. We're finding an actual witch.
Yeah.
Yeah, it almost seems kind of meaningless that he's refusing to cooperate initially. Like, it's just I don't know why he would do that. He's just forcing their hand and making them subpoena what they actually want. Is there some advantage to doing that?
Here's the tactical reason why you do that. And we have talked about this with some of our previous trips up Yodel Mountain, right? So by analogy, let's go back to the Jeff Sessions testimony at his confirmation hearing before Senator Al Franken. And we discussed how it would have been much clearer, right? His defense was, well, you know, there's a potential ambiguity in, was I meeting with Russia as part of the campaign or as, you know, and so all of that could have been resolved if Al Franken, not a lawyer, but good at his job. I mean, if Al Franken had been a lawyer, he would have said, to be clear, Senator Sessions, are you saying that you had no contact whatsoever with the Russian government, either in an official capacity or as a U.S. senator, or in your capacity as a representative of the campaign, or in any other capacity from the time period X to Y, right? Like, that's how I would have locked up that question. And you wait and you listen. And one of the things you're trained as a lawyer to do is when you say, did you ever do X, and somebody gives you weasel words or incomplete answer, you're trained as a lawyer to say, okay, respectfully, my question was, have you ever done X? So you know, and you just go back and you don't let them get right. away with the weasel words.
So what's the connection? So you're saying,
so the connection,
the
here
reason
is,
he's not giving up stuff voluntarily is he's just not putting himself in that, in any sort of vulnerable position.
What, by not complying voluntarily and forcing them to issue a subpoena? Well, number one, it requires a certain political will to go issue the subpoena. I think we're going to see this. So there's one sort of potential point of failure. And number two, you are requiring them to put into writing exactly what they want, to which you can then craft your response based on exactly what they've said, as opposed to a kind of wide ranging, why don't you appear and we might ask you a whole bunch of different things, right? Okay. So, you know, that's the tactical move there.
So no progress on Yodel Mountain for this specific question, but it's gearing up for Yodel Mountain. It's kind of,
I want to go back. I want to repeat this, you know, every Trump episode, that, you know, these kinds of investigations, particularly criminal investigations, typically take years, you know, 18 months to several years to put together. So, you know, expecting Trump to be impeached by, you know, the end of summer, is not realistic. And, and it plays into, what pro-Trump Republicans want, which is, oh, come on, like, you haven't found it yet. If you haven't found it yet, there's nothing there. Let's move on.
Yeah. And which is why sorry to plug my show, is why in my episode today, I talked about the scandal that's not, doesn't require an investigation, which is the healthcare bill. So we can just take out Republicans on the basis of this terrible bill, because it's right out there in the open. So there you go.
Yep. No, if you are not listening to Serious Inquiries Only and you like the show, you will love Serious Inquiries Only. Down, you know, pause this, go to your podcast browser, iTunes, whatever, and subscribe to Serious Inquiries Only. It's great stuff.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. Mm-hmm. And that does it. So on with the rest of the show. Down. The law. Down. The law. Down. Down. Andrew, another story hot off the presses here. I don't know if everybody saw the Kathy Griffin picture where she had a fake severed, fake severed Donald Trump head. And it was some sort of photo shoot for something. I don't actually know what she was promoting, but caused a stir. Of course. And she's now, I just found out, I think just now, she's been let go from CNN and fired from her like New Year's Eve job. I don't know why that's necessary, but anyway, I wanted to know, this seems like something that is pretty far. I mean, we talk about hate speech and what that actually is, and the legal definition, which I think you've said before is kind of an imminent threat, you know, more in that area. And I just wonder, what are the lines on something like this? Is this the kind of thing where it's like, yeah, that's a pretty imminent threat. But then again, as you'll recall, there was plenty of hanging Obama in effigy and stuff like that, that I don't really remember too much of a fuss about. So what's going on here?
Yeah. And you have that exactly right, that that the same standard you would use to analyze the Kathy Griffin severed head of Donald Trump is the line of cases going back to Brandenburg versus Ohio about hate speech, which protects all sorts of speech up until you have what is known in the Supreme Court jurisprudence as imminent danger, and that is a substantial likelihood of imminent violence in response to the message, right? So what does that mean? That means I am standing in front and whipping up the mob, and I say, now let's go march into downtown Baltimore and start destroying stuff. And then we do that, and we go destroy, like,
or you're at a political rally and you chant lock her up or something like that. Is that what you're saying?
No. Yeah, but that's exactly right. Like, look, that lock her up was reprehensible. And it exposed, I think, you know, the worst in American politics right now. But I wouldn't want to lock up the people chanting lock them up. Right? Like, that, it, in my view, it has value. And we are discussing that right now, of like the debasement of our political discourse. In a way, you know, right, that's the right response when you have a major political party. I mean, it's astonishing to me that the electorate did what the electorate did, and in you know, many ways that's on us.
But that was a fine line though, because I know we've talked about when Trump or I think maybe it was someone else possibly ordered violence on protesters from the pulpit there. That's a little different, right?
Right. And again, think about it. It's the exact same imminence test, right? Like when Donald Trump looks at somebody, and this is truly astonishing and reprehensible, when he looks at somebody and says, "Why don't you knock the crap out of him?" Right. Yeah. Direct quote. Well, that would fall on the other side of the line. That is inciting violence against a specific individual in a crowd of people who are waiting to do what you said. And yes, that should be a crime, right? There's no debating that. Right. Like that's not something that we can put out. Right. Like when they chant lock her up, we went and we put out, you know, opening arguments number 13 and said, well, no, actually, like there's no basis for this. And you're wrong about the law. When somebody gets punched in the face because they're protesting at a Trump rally, there's no debate. Right. We can't do an opening arguments about like, well, here's why it was wrong to punch them in the face. Well, you know, that doesn't do a whole lot of good to the guy who's got the punched in face. I do want to point out, as you have pointed out, that however deplorable it is and the long historical tradition of burning in effigy as being part of political speech, it's something that I would not want to lose and take away. Now, there is, in my view, where it moves closer to the line is when it has the racial component to that. In other words,
changes it legally?
In my view, it could, depending on the content of the rest of the speech, right? Mm. So in other words, there was a prominent official who not only engaged in the like effigy of Obama, the hanging the noose, but said, you know, I call that the Black House now, right? Like, and you could see, right, in that situation where the potential incitement seems to wash over from an individual to a group of people, be it African Americans or in many cases Muslims, because of the, you know, misguided belief by morons. I shouldn't even call it misguided, right? Like the idiot belief by people who are too dumb to listen to the show that that President Obama was a Muslim, that when you are applying that imminent danger test, you might look at, are other members of that group potentially at risk, right? Like, so in other words, when you have a hate mob that is burning President Trump in effigy, the question is there imminent danger to Trump or his supporters, right? Like who's going to be hurt? Where is the source of the potential violence? And I think that there's a slight different, right? Like it's kind of hard in a group of people to identify usually, you know, who might be a Trump supporter, you know, and again, you can come up with a scenario, right? You could easily with a scenario. If we had a Liz Warren rally and there were, you know, people in Pepe the Frog shirts and Make America Great Again hats, and Liz Warren says, you know, horrible stuff about Donald Trump, and anybody who supports Donald Trump should be, you know, taken out back and have the crap beaten out of them, which our next president, Elizabeth Warren, would not say. But if she did,
would just make them define what in assumpt it was, which I think is an appropriate appropriate way to approach Trump supporters.
Well, that's how we do it, right? We instead of violence, we use intellectual knowledge. Intimidation. you can come up with a scenario on the other side in which there is imminent danger. I'm just pointing out that I think that there's a little bit of an asymmetry because the hatred directed towards Obama
there's
was
like
not
some
just
spillover damage that there isn't in the case of Trump.
Right. There's racial and religious hatred that was part of that as well that I don't see, right? Like, in other words, nobody is saying cut off the head of Donald Trump and also, you know, 70-year-old white guys, right? Like there isn't that level of additional danger. Yeah.
With narcissistic personality disorders. Now, maybe, I guess if you get more specific, maybe it's something you could, No.
Yeah, let me say very, very clearly though, in addition to kind of the academic tenor of this question, don't take legal advice from a podcast. I want to be clear from our podcast perspective, like, we are in no way, I mean, we're an anti-violence podcast. We're a pro-pacifist podcast. We are in no way advocating violence towards Donald Trump. And the Secret Service takes very seriously potential threats against the president. So, you know, evaluating and saying that this kind of speech is part of the political landscape is not the same as saying, I mean, you know, the Secret Service paid Kathy Griffin a visit. And I, at least, would be very careful. And yeah. I urge caution upon my clients in saying something that would, that could potentially be construed as a threat. Because, you know, that, I mean, that's like, you know, it's the answer I give when you see these, you know, like sovereign citizen videos of people saying, well, you know, belligerently look at the traffic cop who pulls you over and yell, am I being detained? Am I being detained? And like, there are an awful lot of people, I don't think we need to go into it, for whom I would not recommend being belligerent to a cop because, yeah. you know, when you vindicating your rights down the line is sort of cold comfort, you know, after you've been arrested right. That's exactly right. And, and this is a case where it seems pretty clear to me that, if you're drawing attention to yourself as a comedian, that's one thing. But, I certainly would not play around with anything that could potentially be construed as a threat against the president or vice president of the United States. You know, think of that like the, should I crack my best? I've got a bomb under, you know, in my underpants joke yeah. while I'm waiting in line at the airport. Like, you know, maybe no. do that some other point.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's not really a topic for this show, but I think it's just frustrating that she fully apologized and like did it and said, yeah, I did it. Because I think that was too far. My personal view, just my opinion, like I think that picture is too far. I actually don't really, I didn't like it. It's not something I would support doing as much as I hate Trump. I think it's too far. And she apologized. She did her best to make amends. And then, nope, we still have to go. We still have to try to get rid of her from our entire society. And she has to be an outcast. And it just seems a little asymmetrical to me. And it's frustrating, but that's a topic for a different podcast, I think.
I agree. I agree 100% with that.
All right. Well, it is time for it's one of our favorite times because let's see, it's Friday. And so that is Top Patron Friday. And that is just one of the best. It's just one of the best days. This is a fact. Legal fact. We can cite you the statute. Top Patron Friday is one of the top two best days.
Thank you to Roger Metcalf, Danny Rosari, our pal Eli Bosnick, Dave Nichols of Positively Doubtful Podcast, Steve Sigmund, Jim Grove, Amanda Lipnack, Heather Loveridge, Geeker 41, Sean Pitty, Ian and Allie. Thank you to Matthew Vernon, Violet Page Hall, Heath Enright, Jeffrey Maynor, The Wayward Willis, Detective Matthew Maxson, and his podcast, The Odd Atheist Friend Show. Thomas, you were just recently a guest on there.
Yeah, a couple weeks back.
Yeah. Thank you to Dave Lovely. Thanks to Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense. Thanks to Sharon Frankel, host of the delightful podcast Habeas Humor and Thomas's go-to appellate lawyer on Thomas Takes the Bar Exam. Thanks, Squick Thinger, Ian Ryan, Matthew Hillier, Aaron Grady, Brandon Smith, TV Is My Girlfriend, and C6 Sarah.
And thank you to Hunter Ash, Torsten Skurv, Adopt a Homeless Pet, and Oppose Declawing and Ear Docking, Philip Stromberg, You Are Here Sci-Fi Audio Drama. Ooh, that is, by the way, our editor, Brian. RJ Predatory Journal Publisher Ratio. Thomas's missing feet. Yeah.
I was just going to say, RJ Radio is winning the inter-office war, so keep it up. And you got to step your game up if you're in RJ's office.
Yeah, yeah. And Stephen Boyd at DJ Empirical, campquest.org, campquest.org, campquest.org. Torsten Peel of Prosperity Karma. JT Loves His Hubby Logan. Squaring the Strange Podcast, Soggy Pants, John Bodley Esquire, Kaylee Reiser, Sakashite Fukusumi, Michael Schaefer of Reason Real Estate, The Electronic Frontier Foundation at EFF.org, The NetSec Heathen, Jessica Wilson, Mark Smith, Thomas McCormick, Dane Griffith, Frederick Elstromer, Sammy Reven, Michael Rops, Marissa Alexa McCool, Conrad Michaels, and Zabby. Thank you guys so much for being our top patrons. And now I could cite the statute, but I don't need to because you all will know that this is one of the worst times of the week for me and the best time for all you Schadenfreude observers out there. It's time for TTTDBE.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
Yeah. And I think the new Thomas, knowing that we're engaging in some issue spotting, I've got optimism here.
I think, I'll tell you what, I sure as hell can eliminate two answers like no one's business. So I've got all the confidence in that because that's my goal.
All right. Here we go. A purse snatcher ran up to a woman, grabbed her purse, and ran off. There was a witness at the scene. The witness worked with the police a few days later to try and create a composite sketch of the purse snatcher. Boy, that is a tough word to say. This was used by the police to capture the purported purse snatcher. The witness died several days before the trial. When the witness's drawing was offered by the prosecution as evidence at trial, is the trial judge likely to accept it as admissible evidence? Okay? So, witness goes to the police, they create a composite sketch used as evidence. That witness dies before trial. Can they admit the sketch without the witness to authenticate the sketch?
A question that I do not know the answer to. So let's look forward to picking the right answer.
All right.
On this purported purse snatcher. I think you fail the asking of the bar exam question today. Just so we're on the same footing.
All right. Answer A, yes, because the police took it and used it to find someone. Therefore, it must be an accurate representation of the perpetrator. The exhibit must be admitted. B, yes, because it is in the nature of the written recollection of the decedent at a time close to the crime and therefore has testimonial reliability. C, no, because the defense has had no opportunity to cross-examine the witness under oath about the drawing prior to her death, and such sketches are inherently unreliable in any event. Or D, no, because it was drawn up days after the event and is in violation of the best evidence rule.
All right, Andrew. I dare say I'm hoping I can get a question right here. I'm going to eliminate two answers, but I'm going to go so far as to even maybe try to get the right answer, as unheard of as that is. So A sounds ridiculous to me. That's got to be a clear elimination. What did it say? Like because it's used to find people. So that means it's right. Usually
must be accurate and the exhibit must be admitted. We're biasing our pool a little bit here, but
A is a clear no. If you choose A, you're wrong and you should feel bad. Or are you? I usually try to throw that in. Some people still choose it. And so I'm going to say A is a hard elimination. Done. I'm also going to say for my other firm elimination here, I'm going to say D because I don't think, I mean, it has words that sound law-y. We've got the violation of the best evidence rule, but it almost seems like the opposite of that. It seems to me like, no, this is the best evidence rule. It seems like the best evidence would have been maybe the witness testimony, but given that that's gone from what I've learned from you, given that that's no longer appropriate, the drawing is kind of the best evidence that we have. So I think that's got to be a wrong answer, though. So I'm eliminating A and D. So B and C seem plausible. But the thing about C for me is the end of it. Like it starts off as an answer I would have fallen for, and then it says, and such sketches are inherently unreliable in any event. I don't think that would be how the law would work. Like that, you know, we recognize that sketches are unreliable. So you're not going to, I don't know. I think that it's as much as the wording of B is a little weird. So it says, because it is in the nature of the written recollection of the decedent. It's a little odd wording, but this sounds the most right to me. Someone who has not studied this at all and has no reason to know the right answer. it says, because it is in the nature of the written recollection of the decedent at a time close to the crime and therefore has testimonial reliability, sounds like the most appropriate legal language to me. Like it's not like it proves anything, but it has testimonial reliability. I'm going to go with B, final answer, and B and C being the two. So if anyone wants to get this right, you guess C.
Okay. And if you would like to guess C or otherwise play along with Thomas Takes the Bar Exam, you may do so on Twitter by quoting and retweeting out our announcement. Include the hashtag TTTBE. Put in your reasons. Last week, a gloriously, delightfully nerdy picture won. We pick either the first correct answer, the best correct answer, the best explanation, the explanation that makes us laugh, whatever it is. We love seeing all your responses. I think this is a popular and fun party game. Clearly, people are enjoying playing along. Play along with us. And if you've never sent us an answer before, send us one this week.
Absolutely. You can laugh at me every time when I clearly guess the wrong of them 50-50. It's fun. It's fun. Everyone has fun except me. All right. Well, that does it for our show today and this week. Thanks for a great week. Thanks for, you know, if you were someone who was mixed on Tuesday's episode, that's okay. We will talk about that on Tuesday, next Tuesday. And but this episode was great, of course, and I love being able to get quick reactions to the news. Thanks, Andrew, for the hard work you put in for that, and for me for outsourcing that to Brian. And we will see you guys next week.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.